Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A few quick notes for any and all of our new listeners. First, thanks for tuning in. We are a free educational podcast that has been on the web now for 4.5 years, and we have archived over 200 episodes. If you search our archives, you will find discussions from scholars on everything from ancient Christian funerals to religion and quantum physics. And we also feature everyday folks on topics such as being a missionary, to preaching to cowboys, to building a church in just 1 week. Second, we are free to the public on iTunes and also have an RSS feed, for those of you who know what that is. We invite you to subscribe. Finally, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where you will get updates on forthcoming shows and a few interesting tidbits and pictures here and there. So please connect with us there. We'd love the company, and we'd love your comments. And now for today's show, which takes us into new territory in that I will be interviewing two guests at the same time. Now, this almost happened a few months back, but I was a little bit nervous about the audio quality. However, the good folks at BYU have promised to outfit our guests with the most modern equipment available. I've also informed the guests not to talk over one another or engage in fisticuffs, lest I use my magic bell to shock them into better behavior. It didn't work.
We'll be sure to behave well, Tony.
Okay. You will behave well. All right. Those two guests are David E. Campbell, a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, and J. Quinn Monson, associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University. They, along with their other co-author, John Green, have recently published the book, Seeking the Promised Land: Mormons and American Politics, the subject of today's show. Both David and Quinn have published numerous articles and books, with David having recently helped Robert Putnam out of the gutter, so to speak, with their new book, American Grace, and Quinn has published a billion articles on American politics stuff. For those of you not in the know, the gutter reference was to Robert Putnam's best-selling book, Bowling Alone. I like to think of myself as being rhetorically witty sometimes. There's the problem. I switched the bell to my shock collar. Okay. All right. We will link to David and Quinn's respective bios, their most recent book, and a bunch of other fun stuff on our website. So check all of that out. Quinn, David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, Tony. Thank you very much.
All right. Let's start out with a little sound check here to let listeners know whose voice is associated with what person. I will have each of you say, this is, and then insert your name and something a little bit interesting about yourself so that we can identify your voices. And if you two sound too similar, I'm just going to edit one of you to sound like a chipmunk later on before posting this. David, you go first.
My name is Dave Campbell, and I was born and raised in the bustling metropolis of Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada.
And Quinn.
It's Quinn Monson, and my name is Quinn because I am the fifth of six boys. There's nine kids, but six boys. So they opted for Quinn as the number, the Latin number, over Septimus.
Ah, okay. I was thinking it was the mighty Quinn for the...
I don't think Septimus was a serious option, people to say.
All right. Good. See, I learn something new every day. So Dave is Canadian, and Quinn, with the deeper voice, by the way, is the fifth of six kids. All right. Next thing I want to do is identify both of you as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as you do self-identify in your book. Now, John Green, your third co-author, is not a Mormon. And I'm making this clear because I am going to be asking you some personal reflections throughout our conversation, and I want to know, listeners, where you folks are coming from. Let's start out with my usual question for guests, and that question is, why did you write this book, Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons and American Politics?
Well, Tony, this is Dave Campbell. There's actually kind of an interesting story behind this book. Quinn and I were both undergraduates at BYU. We were majors in political science. We were on our way to graduate school, different graduate programs, but both on our way to grad school. And we had a conversation in the student union at BYU over a taco or something, in which we hatched a plan to one day write a book about Mormons and politics. And both of us said, but let's wait until we get tenure. And frankly, that's exactly what happened. And we ended up bringing John Green into the project because even though John himself is not LDS, he speaks Mormon. He grew up in Colorado, and he gave us a good insight and a good perspective, kind of half in the culture, familiar with it, but also an outsider's view. But it's also worth noting that we wanted to write this book, and I think we recognized even at the time, because there really is very little, almost nothing, written in social science on Mormons as a group. You know, there are references here and there, but very little that's been done comprehensively, and certainly not as much as you would expect given the size of the Mormon population. You know, there are almost as many Mormons in America as Jews, and there's far more work on Judaism than there is on Mormonism.
There's nice, this is Quinn, there's nice work by sociologists and historians. There's almost nothing by political scientists. There's been a few scattered articles and other things, but this is our attempt to put something out there that we hope is definitive, for now at least, on the topic of Mormons and politics.
Yeah, I should note that one of our frequent guests, Rod Stark, has written a significant amount on Mormons in his illustrious career. And I should also note, when I read Seeking the Promised Land, and that was one of your reasons for writing this book, is that there hasn't been much discussion by political scientists on this. I went back and I counted the number of episodes where we had significant amount of content devoted to the Latter-day Saints. And we had, depending on how you count it, 6 or 7 episodes out of our 220, and that includes this one. So in the span of those episodes, I am at the 3% rate. So I'm matching it. So
I think you should ding the bell now.
Ah! Okay. All right. So let's get into this book. Your book is ostensibly about Mormons in American politics, as the subtitle suggests, but there's actually a great deal of basic information about the Latter-day Saints, and there's also wonderful information about the sociology of religion, which really makes this book a comprehensive read. I want to start out with Quinn and what y'all do in the first few chapters, and focus on Mormons as a peculiar people, which is your term, by the way. Why do you say Mormons are peculiar? Is it just because Utah has the highest per capita consumption of Jell-O in the U.S., or something else?
No, I think it's the birth rate in Utah that we were referring to. But seriously, actually, the term isn't actually ours. It's a term that we appropriate from Scripture, from the Old Testament, and it's an odd term to be sure, but it's one that Mormons self-identify with pretty readily and have adopted, even though it sounds different. And it's precisely because it sounds different. It's a way to sort of announce that your distinctiveness. So we refer to it in that same way, and part of what we do in that first part of the book is see if we can demonstrate with data whether or not Mormons are really that distinctive.
And are they?
Oh yeah, in a number of ways. And so one of the things we start with is trying to demonstrate Mormon distinctiveness on measures that Mormons have in common with other religious groups. So there's a problem here in that one of the things about Mormonism is that there are a number of beliefs and elements of Mormon theology that are so different that they're not even comparable. You can't ask members of another religious tradition whether they believe in the Book of Mormon or in a living prophet. That's just not part of it at all. But there are some things that you can compare in terms of belief in God and belief in life after death and heaven and hell and miracles and other things. And what you find among Mormons is that they are, their religiosity and their belief in these religious things is always at a very high level. A lot of times it's at the highest level when you compare across different religious traditions. So they're distinctive in their belief and practice. And then you move to this whole set of items in which they're distinctive because nobody shares these beliefs, and these beliefs are a prominent part of what makes up Mormonism.
Give us a flavor for some of those distinctive beliefs.
Well, we have a little table in the book where we talk about things that are distinctive and emphasized as part of Mormon theology. So I would put belief in the Book of Mormon at the top of that list, and a distinction in terms of how Mormons characterize what other Christians call the Trinity. So a belief that God and Jesus Christ are distinct and have bodies, a belief in modern-day prophets, including Joseph Smith, who founded the church, and the belief that the current president of the church is a prophet, and then unique things like temple rites that Mormons engage in. Those are all very unique and make Mormons quite distinctive.
One of the things that you mentioned in terms of the distinctiveness is that this raises what you call the paradox of Mormonism, that it is quintessentially an American religion, having been founded in America, but still outside of America. Explain that.
Founded in America and in a country that is has as its base its religious freedom and a degree of tolerance, and yet so distinctive and outside that mainstream that Mormons were subject to rejection by the larger culture, and still are to some extent. It's that tension is still there.
That is very interesting. And part of this book, you not only say that there is a distinct tension, but you interrogate this notion that Mormonism might be a distinct ethnic group, or maybe a better way to put it is a religio-ethnic group. Discuss what that means, because for me, that was an extremely interesting part of this book.
Well, traditionally, you think of ethnicity as being as having some kind of genetic component, as having to do with who your parents are, in particular. And so we sort of step away from making a full-throated case that Mormons are an ethnic group, but they certainly share some characteristics of an ethnic group in terms of a very distinctive subculture, a sense of self-identity that resembles an ethnicity. We refer to, and Mormons refer to themselves as a people in a way that you sometimes see when you think about other ethnic groups. And so maybe not quite, I think the bridge between sort of a religious and ethnic group is the most common one you think of is Judaism. I don't think Mormons are quite at that level in terms of thinking of it as an ethnicity and apart from the religion, but certainly for Mormons who self-identify as such, you start to adopt not just religious beliefs, but there are cultural things that enter into your thinking as well. There's a language that permeates Mormonism. There's traditions and other things that permeate it that make you part of a quasi-ethnic group.
You mentioned that before, the language of Mormonism, and you'd mentioned that your other co-author, John Green, speaks the language of Mormon, or at least understands the language of Mormon. Now, I have to admit, I've interacted with David Campbell for many years. I think I've met you one or two times before, Quinn. And you all sound the same to me. I mean, there's nothing strange when you're talking. So what do you mean about the language of Mormon?
I think if you hung around a Mormon ward, which is a Mormon congregation, so there I've used a Mormon term that's different. Normally when you say ward, you mean a precinct or a political entity. Well, for Mormons, that's a congregation. So there are a host of terms, some borrowed and then adapted and changed from other religious traditions, and some invented by Mormons that refer to distinctive beliefs, that refer to temple beliefs, that refer to things about families, that are sort of catchphrases. And we found ourselves, as we wrote, occasionally using those, and what John was particularly good at was flagging that and making sure that we put a parenthesis and explained the term. So we had to actually come up with a convention as we wrote to explain these unique terms when they came up.
Give me an example of one or two of these terms that maybe John Green caught.
Boy, let's see. I think the basic unit of Mormon congregations, the ward or the stake, is a term. I think there's colloquialisms like elder that are used in other churches but mean something different for Mormons.
Tony, this is Dave. Theologically, some of the terms that are used that are very common in Mormonism but sound maybe unusual outside of the culture would include the pre-existence, which is to Mormons a state of being before you are born mortally. Another example would be Mormons have what other Christians would refer to as communion, but what they call the sacrament. So the term sacrament doesn't refer to a rite the way it does in most other faiths. It actually refers to communion, which can also be a little confusing. More casually, a Mormon can spout a sentence like the following. I was at FHE last week talking about my MTC experience, and then how I went to BYU, and then I talked to my Elders Quorum president about how I might eventually end up in the high priest group, and he said he'd refer to that to the bishopric. Now, to a Mormon, that sentence makes complete sense, but I'm going to bet to most of your listeners that was complete gibberish.
Yeah,
and I can attest that made complete sense to me.
Yeah, and I can attest that it sounded like complete gibberish. In fact, it sounded like a university administrator starting a new program with all those acronyms there, and I just, at about the fourth word, my eyes glazed over, and I'm like, okay, I don't need to listen to this. It is rather fascinating because I have to admit that I did not know, Dave, that you were a Mormon until very recently. You look fairly normal, and this brings me back to in a normal, in a loving Christian kind of way, I say that. I'm going to get grief for that statement. But it brings it back to this religio-ethnic distinction that you have, and also this paradox with Mormonism. It's uniquely American, but it's also other. It's distinct in that respect. And I want to ask each of you to reflect a little bit upon this, because again, from my viewing you, you don't look like a distinct group. You look like everyday Americans, and ethnic groups usually are defined by some feature. It might be some physical feature that individuals tend to share. It might be the clothing that they wear that makes them very distinct. But it would be hard to pick out a Mormon from an average American in a large group. That's from my end looking in. But from the group itself, from Mormons itself, there's going to be a much different view, is that you're looking at the rest of the world and understanding that the rest of the world is different from you. To what extent did each of you experience this religio-ethnic feeling in your own experiences? Because both of you, you mentioned you met at BYU, but then you went out into the broader world beyond Utah. Quinn, you went to the Ohio State University, and Dave, you went to the Harvard University. Give us reflections. Did you really know that you were Mormon? Did you feel your Mormon ethnicity, quote unquote, when you were out there at Harvard and Ohio and such?
I'll start. I grew up in the Mormon heartland of Utah, and so I'm not sure I had too much experience with that, except for a year in eighth grade where my family lived in Virginia. I was surrounded by Mormons when I went to elementary school and junior high school and high school. The school is 90% Mormon kids, so almost all of my friends, with just a few exceptions growing up, were other Latter-day Saints. And so I don't think I noticed the distinctiveness as much, actually, until I went off to graduate school. And then I'm one of very few Mormons at Ohio State, even, and one of a couple in the political science department. And at that point, you realize that people don't notice right away. So your comment that you didn't notice anything terribly different about us, but you would notice if you spent a lot of time with us. And so, if you spent a week shadowing me, the differences would become apparent over time in terms of how much time and effort I spend with stuff related to church, how it affects the way I interact with my family. And there aren't a lot of outward things that you would notice just by looking, but they exist nonetheless. And if you were to embed yourself in a Mormon world or Mormon culture, those things would start to become readily apparent.
Yeah, there is that in graduate school, that first, I think, rite of passage I remember after our first methods statistical test, everybody says, let's go out to the bar and drink to forget this exam. But that might have been difficult for you.
Yeah, so I would go and have a few peanuts and a Diet Coke, and it was nice because the bartender thought I was a designated driver, so I always got them for free.
Oh, there's a win. Dave, how about you at Harvard and growing up in Canada?
Well, yeah, my experience is a little different than Quinn's in that I did not grow up in an area that was heavily LDS. There actually is a part of Canada not that far from where I was raised that is actually pretty Mormon, but I'm from slightly outside of that range. So I did grow up with a very conscious sense that I was different, and I think it's fair to say that when I was in high school, I kind of settled on Mormonism as my identity. You know, a lot of high school kids, adolescents, sort of search for who they are. And for me, that's what I kind of settled on. And so when I went to college, it actually wasn't originally at BYU. I started at the University of Calgary in Canada, and I lived in the dorms there. And in Alberta, the province I was raised in, the drinking age is only 18, which means that alcohol use is rampant in Alberta universities, much more so, believe it or not, than even American schools, just because it's legal. The student union runs multiple bars all around campus. And so I was very conscious of the fact that not only was it that I didn't drink, but that, you know, I would get up early on Sunday morning and I would go to church and such. So I was aware of that. I did end up at BYU, where, of course, I was surrounded by Mormons. But by the time I got to Harvard, I was married. I had a child. Now, those things are not necessarily because I was LDS, but it's certainly consistent with what you'd expect from someone who's LDS. So that set me apart. And to this day, I have friends I knew in grad school who remember me as the married guy with the kid. And they would plot their own progress or lack thereof by comparing the height of my daughter to where they were on their dissertation. So as she got taller and they kept making no progress, they would get a little depressed. But
yeah, I should mention, just for those of you who have not gone through the graduate school experience, to be married with kids in graduate school and then finish the dissertation process is a remarkable feat, to say the least. My family, we waited till after tenure in order to have children. So kudos to you.
Well, the credit actually goes to my wife, who was truly a saint through this whole period, but somehow we made it work.
I have to cut in and give credit to my wife, too, because I had three kids when I finished, and it was the most difficult summer of my entire life with a newborn baby at home and finishing a dissertation.
But you turned out well.
And I hope so.
You did. No, you got tenure and everything. You're very well respected. So
now, one thing I should add about my experience at Harvard is it's easy, I think, to fall into the caricature of, you know, the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed Mormon kid comes to Harvard and gets eaten alive by all these secular liberals there. But that actually was not my experience at all. In fact, I vividly remember the very first time I met with my initial mentor, Sid Verba, a name some of your listeners will know, some may not, but those who do not know the name, trust me, Sid Verba is a monumental figure in political science and really social science generally. And I remember sitting across the desk from Sid, and he said to me, looking at my record and realizing that I was LDS, he said, "Oh, this is going to be great. You've had experience that is going to benefit your research. You should write about religion." He didn't necessarily say I should write about Mormonism, but he did feel like I would have insight into religion in a way that many other scholars wouldn't. And he and many other faculty I knew at Harvard all encouraged me in that direction because they could see that religion was going to become a bigger topic of study, even though at the time it was really not. It was kind of a backwater. And so in that sense, the fact that I came from this distinctive background was, if anything, an advantage, or at least an advantage in terms of settling on a research agenda.
Yeah, get the religion guy to write about religion, I guess. So, yeah, and that sounds a little bit stereotypical to me, but it worked out very well. And you were right. When did you go to graduate school, by the way, Dave?
Started in 1996.
Okay. All right. So you're a little bit younger than I am. But yeah, I was in the 80s doing that, and I wasn't particularly religious at the time. I actually became a little bit more religious through my research in interacting with a number of religious individuals. So it wasn't the case for me, you know, get the religious guy to do the religion thing. I just saw it as a unique and interesting topic. Let me probe a little bit more on this religio-ethnic identity construction. In part because, again, this is one of the most fascinating parts that I found about your book. It really challenged my thinking on the way I conceive of different groups. But one thing that's very unique about the Mormons is that you're all over the world. You bring people back to Provo, to Salt Lake City, you know, missions, or you're sent all over the place. I have to admit, I've been to Provo a few times, beautiful city, and it has this restaurant row that has every conceivable ethnic restaurant you can imagine, Peruvian, Bolivian, you know, Togoese, everything is there. To what extent does crafting this Mormon identity, which has some tension with the regular surrounding culture, tend to trump what we normally consider to be ethnic identities, such as, well, you're Latino and I'm Caucasian, or you're African American and that person's Japanese? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think our data is mostly confined to confined to Americans. So we don't have a lot of international experience here, although that I know that that's a real tension in some places around the world, because you're imposing this Mormon culture over another culture, and sometimes the mix is difficult, and sometimes the mix is fun. In the American case, I think what we find is evidence that, for example, converts to Mormonism have a slightly less of an attachment in terms of identity, but it's not that much less. So there is a sort of an adoption of a Mormon identity that comes with joining up and becoming religiously active in the church that then shows through in other ways. And I think what we find evidence for later in the book, in the analysis, is to some degree the religious identity trumps a political identity. So to the extent that your ethnic background in other ways influences you politically, that Mormon identity, for most Mormons at least, becomes quite important and quite influential.
We're going to get to that in a second and be talking more about the politics of this all, but I have one additional question that has always puzzled me, and this relates to the paradox of Mormonism being quintessentially American, but also separate from America. And that's the issue of patriotism. And you mentioned this later in the book, around page 100 or so. Mormons have been one of the most highly persecuted religious groups in American history, to the point where your founder was jailed, was chased down, and was killed. Yet, if you take a look at one subgroup in America that has embraced their love of America more than any other, it's the Mormons. For me, that's just such an odd tension. If I was persecuted that much, I'd be really irritated with America. So what gives with that?
It's a real tension, and I think part of it can be explained by the fact that the Constitution and the American Founding are things that are named in Mormon scripture and talked about by Mormon church leaders from the very beginning, from Joseph Smith forward. So that even though early Mormons especially were persecuted and not treated so well, at the same time, I think they recognized the idea that the religious freedom offered under the Constitution was what allowed them to exist in the first place, and that the freedoms that they had in the United States exceeded those they would have found around the world. And in fact, they knew about that because even in those early days, they were sending missionaries out in around the world and trying to gain converts. And, you know, I have sort of family history stories of you know, great-great-grandfathers being jailed as missionaries because they were breaking the law. You know, so there's that tension, and I think part of it is epitomized by a moment in Mormon history when, upon being, you know, driven out of Illinois, out of Nauvoo, they're beginning their trek west, and the United States goes to war with Mexico, and there's an approach made to Brigham Young, who's now leading the church in after Joseph Smith's death, and they ask him to recruit Mormon men to serve in the military and to form a battalion that later was called the Mormon Battalion. And, you know, some of that was self-interested. The church needed the money, needed the cash to pay for this cross-country trek. But the fact that Brigham Young was able to stir up a little bit of patriotism and at least convince people to join the U.S. Army after having been driven from their homes, that's kind of a remarkable thing to see.
It's absolutely remarkable.
And I think it carries over to a patriotic sense and a suspicion of federal government all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see this reflected in some of the data that we're going to talk about here in a minute. There is one other interesting observation that you also made related to trying to fit into American culture. And this relates to something that I think happened in the 1980s. Something happened with the signage of the church. What was that?
Well, they changed the logo, and that is the. I think this speaks to a response to a larger tension. So in the book, we talk about this two-front war, the distinctiveness that Mormons feel is felt from two different directions. On the one hand, they're extremely religious and are therefore distinctive from the secular American culture on sort of the political left. And on the other hand, even though you would think that Mormons would share common cause with other religious people and other Christians, their distinctive beliefs and theology have them sometimes at loggerheads, at odds with other Christians, and particularly evangelical Christians who don't accept them as Christian. And so part of that is that change in logo. That's just an illustration of sort of a self-conscious response to restate that we are Christian. Mormons are Christian, and we're going to make the name of Jesus Christ bigger in our logo to emphasize that point.
When I read that in the book, I went out, and there's a temple not too far from us. Washington actually has a fairly substantial Mormon population. And I looked at the signage, and I noticed that Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Jesus Christ part, was much bigger. It's bold. It sits on top, and it has, you know, nice layering of how the words all occur. And I was like, oh, that is really interesting.
In the same time period, I don't remember the exact sequence, but around the same time, the Book of Mormon title was actually changed, and a subtitle was added, the Book of Mormon : Another Testament of Jesus Christ. The same kind of idea being these distinctive beliefs ought to be considered Christian, that what makes us distinctive isn't unchristian, it's very Christian. And that's just part of that tension that exists that Mormons experience.
Yeah, and you mentioned that there's often tension with evangelicals, and I tend to walk in evangelical circles, and I know that there is a lot of distrust, mistrust, anger toward Mormons in many respects, but it's, you know, so I can experience that from my end and things, but people often ask me, do you consider Mormons to be Christian? I said, yeah, you know, yeah, sure, why not? I'm not too big on labels and that kind of stuff. Okay, so let's move along here. You already had mentioned that much of this religious distinctiveness can manifest itself in other ways, specifically in political distinctiveness. And one thing that we note in presidential campaigns is that rarely, if ever, do candidates visit Utah. David, I want to bring you into the conversation here again and discuss what makes Mormons politically distinct and why. Why don't those presidential candidates ever make whistle-stop tours in Salt Lake City?
Well, the first thing to note, which explains why you're correct, you don't find presidential candidates visiting Utah or much advertising in presidential campaigns, is that as a group, Mormons, who of course are concentrated in Utah, are a very Republican-leaning group. In fact, they are the most Republican of any religious group in America. They're not quite the most politically homogeneous group, because it turns out both Jews and black Protestants are a little more likely to be Democrats than Mormons are likely to be Republicans, but still a very heavily Republican group. But it's also important to note that, historically speaking, that's a relatively new development that has not always been the case. There was once a time, actually back at the beginning of the 20th century, when Mormons were almost monolithically Democratic. That's largely because the Republican Party was actually founded to stamp out Mormonism, but somehow Mormons have managed to get over that now. But throughout much of the 20th century, Mormons split their votes between the two parties. And it really wasn't until the second half of the 20th century that we see this drift toward the Republican majority that we now observe.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is happening around the 1950s, 1960s? Why is there this shift and change?
Well, I think there's an explanation that rests on what was happening inside the church, but then it's also important to remind ourselves of what was happening outside of the LDS church, and that is just in American politics in general, or what you might say is what's happening within the parties. So within the church, we do see an increasing emphasis on issues that ended up resonating with the political divisions in the country. So through the 1950s in particular, there was a strong emphasis placed within the LDS church on anti-communism. And of course, that was more likely to line up with the Republicans. And then there was also a lot of concern over self-sufficiency and a rejection of the idea of the welfare state. And of course, that also resonated with the Republican Party. But I would say that the really dramatic shift of Mormons toward the Republicans didn't really come until social issues like abortion, like a women's role, like gay rights, until those came onto the agenda, you still found a pretty healthy plurality, or at least a healthy minority of Democrats among Mormons. But once the social issues came on the scene and what is sometimes called the God gap appeared, not just among Mormons, but among Americans in general, whereby folks who are more religious, or at least white folks who are more religious, ended up in the Republican camp, Mormons just kind of followed along. So one way to think about this is if it's white, highly religious voters who are voting Republican, well, there's no group in America that are more religious or more white, frankly, than Mormons. So it would make sense that they would end up supporting the Republican Party in large numbers as they do.
You mentioned something called the God gap, and we've talked about that a few times on the podcast, but probably not for the past 2 years. I kind of let it slip after the last presidential campaign. Explain what you mean by the God gap and how religious voting has changed over time.
Well, it used to be the case, and this goes back to certainly the 1950s, but even really through the 60s, maybe even through much of the 1970s, that how religious someone was, remember, no matter how you measure that, frequency of religious attendance, strength of belief in God, anything along those lines, really had nothing to do with whether you were a Republican or a Democrat. So if you go back and look at, say, Eisenhower winning the presidency in 52 and 56, there was no distinction between folks who went to church and those who didn't go to church in how they voted for Eisenhower. But when we look at the present period, how religious somebody is, again, no matter how that's measured, is a pretty strong predictor of whether they identify as a Republican or Democrat, and then, of course, whether they vote Republican or Democratic, with, and this is an important exception, with the exception of black Protestants, another highly religious group who actually vote highly Democratic, which, again, reminds us there's no iron law that says that highly religious folks have to vote one way or the other. And we've seen that historically, and we see it in the contemporary scene as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to ask, and this is a little bit outside of the topic of your book, but it's the issue of geographic proximity. And both of you folks study American politics. I don't study American politics all that much. And I mentioned a few moments ago that Utah is a place that candidates skip over. The Republican candidate can take it for granted. The Democrat candidate largely doesn't want to waste a lot of money or resources trying to win that state, which only has a few electoral votes anyways. We also note that Mormons tend to be geographically concentrated around Utah, Idaho, Montana, Washington State, Oregon. They can be found in Boston and Columbus, but there is this kind of geographical proximity here. Is there anything to geographical proximity that tends to create political cohesion?
Well, one factor that I think helps to explain the Mormon trend toward Republicanness is not just their geographic proximity to one another, but their geographic location. So the states that you just mentioned, you know, the western, the sagebrush states, whether they have a large Mormon population or not, have a tendency to favor the Republicans. So Montana is not a state that has a particularly large LDS population, but also a state that, you know, is very much a red state, a Republican state. So that's some of what's going on. When it comes to geographic proximity, there, I think the important aspect is not so much that we have a lot of Mormons in the state of Utah, but rather that Mormons form very tight-knit communities, frankly, wherever they are, but if they're in large numbers, then those communities just become all the more inclusive. And that kind of enables people to interact with one another and share political views and philosophies that probably does have a self-reinforcing nature and sort of boosts up the Republicanness of the group. Looks like Quinn wants to get in here on a point.
Yeah, Tony. One of the things to point out is that as we get into the data in the book, we work pretty hard to develop some scales of what we call Mormonness. I mean, they're based on traditional religiosity measures and from sociology and political science work and other work, and we came up with four: an activity index that measures sort of traditional types of religiosity and religious behavior, an authority index that measures sort of degree to which you respond to the church's authority and to church leaders, and then an index that we call insularity. It's a measure of sort of social networks, the degree to which your friends and family are also Mormons, and then an identity index that's measuring your self-identity as a Mormon. And when you look at partisanship by those indices of Mormonness, not all of them are strongly predictive. It's actually the authority and the identity index that predict it the strongest. So the social network, the interaction with other Mormons, doesn't seem to be as influential there as the degree to which you believe and follow church authority and your self-identity as a Mormon.
That is actually very fascinating, because I did not anticipate that kind of finding. I would think that a social network would really have a great deal of influence, not only on your religious identity, but on your political identity. Everybody self-monitors and everybody wants to be the same as everybody else in the local neighborhood, so to speak. And the more densely packed you are in your social network, that might affect it. That leads me to this next question, is that we've been talking about Mormons as being highly Republican or highly cohesive in terms of their conservative politics, but there are Mormon Democrats, and they even are in Utah. Who are these folks? You guys went out and tried to find some of them.
Well, the first thing to note is that in a very interesting twist within the Mormon population, it's actually younger Mormons who are more likely to be Republican and older Mormons who are more likely to be Democrats. And of course, that's the exact opposite of what you find in the general population, where it's usually the young folks who are trending toward the Democrats. And that's just a remnant of the fact that there was once a time, as I was saying, where a lot more Mormons were Democrats. Now, in terms of the Democrats themselves, you know, obviously there are going to be a variety of reasons why people end up identifying with one party versus another, but we do generally find that those Mormons who are Democrats or who vote Democratic, they are a little lower on the scales that Quinn was just mentioning, in particular on that authority scale. So they're not maybe quite as inclined to go along with everything the church leaders say, at least right off the bat. They're a little more likely to be maybe seekers or people who want to mull things over and seek their own confirmation of whatever the church might be telling them, and that probably bleeds over into their politics, that they sort of feel more comfortable with the Democratic worldview rather than the Republican one.
Okay. It's not just about party affiliation either. There are some very unique affiliations in terms of different social issues, and these issues bounce around a little bit. So if we unpack the Republicanist box or the Democratness box, we actually find some fairly interesting things here. And I want to run down with you, Dave, some of the things that you found in terms of the issues. Let's kind of break these down. The first one is size of government and economic issues. What do Mormons look like when it comes to those type of things?
Well, certainly on the question of size of government, which, you know, is one of the classic bread and butter issues that divide people ideologically, we find that Mormons are pretty conservative. They would rather see a smaller government, see government do less rather than more. And that's actually true for a number of policy issues, but not all of them. And it's the fact that it's not all of them that's quite significant, because those are aspects, again, of Mormon distinctiveness. So they're politically conservative for the most part, but with a few notable exceptions.
What are some of those exceptions?
Well, one exception is on abortion. Now, generally speaking, Mormons are opposed to abortion, but the Mormon theological view, or at least the policy view the church has on abortion, is a little different than what you find among Catholics or most evangelical Protestants. Abortion is not defined as murder. Abortion is a bad thing, but there are a few cases where abortion can be acceptable within Mormonism, and those are cases of rape and incest and where the life of the mother is in serious jeopardy. And so what we find is that Mormons as a group generally follow their church's belief on abortion, which means that they are the group most likely to endorse abortion, actually, under those circumstances, but then in every other circumstance, be, you know, right alongside the conservative Catholics and the evangelical Protestants who oppose abortion. Another example that is very interesting is Mormon attitudes on immigration. You know, immigration, of course, is an issue that roils the country, but when it comes to that question, Mormons are actually pretty moderate. You might even say they fall a little bit on the liberal side of the spectrum. Certainly much more so than you would expect, given that they're a heavily Republican group. So if you compare, say, you know, your typical conservative Republican to a Mormon conservative Republican, the Mormon is going to be more likely to favor an open border liberal kind of immigration policy.
Do you think that's because of the missionary aspect of Mormonism? As I mentioned before, you go to Provo and you would think that, you know, Mormons, as you just mentioned, very white type of population. But again, the mix of ethnic restaurants and the diversity of people there is pretty astounding, because Mormon missionaries go out to the rest of the world and they come back, and Mormons from other parts of the world come back as well. Do you think that's affecting immigration views?
Well, we not only think it, Tony, our data suggests exactly that. So we're able to look and see what the immigration attitudes are of Mormons who have either served a mission or have not, and then among the missionaries, those who have served in a mission that required them to learn another language. And, which is, of course, not necessarily that they've left the United States, because there are a lot of missionaries in the United States who work with immigrant populations in a variety of languages. And we find a pretty sharp distinction that those folks who have served a mission where they've learned another language, and therefore we would assume another culture, they're actually more sympathetic toward immigrants than those who are not. And I would go so far as to suggest that general mentality, that idea that we should welcome those who are different and a comfort level with those who are of a different culture, actually bleeds over from those who have actually served the mission to other Mormons as well, who maybe haven't actually served in that capacity, but have a family member who has, or are just around in church services as they hear other people talk about their experiences overseas, or again, maybe in the U.S. working with a population of people who are new to the U.S. Looks like Quinn wants to get in here, too.
There's a very pragmatic part of this, too. So, you know, the church, as they issue statements about immigration, talks about, you know, respecting everyone as children of God and so on. But there's a pragmatic side where, in the United States in particular, there's a large group within the church who are illegal immigrants. And so there's this emphasis in the church on obeying the law and so on, but there's a pragmatic side that says, but they're here, and the church also believes in strong families and keeping families together, so what now?
Mm-hmm.
and the pragmatism and the belief in keeping families together seems to win out, where the church comes down on, well, we should keep them together, and wins out in a very pragmatic way, in the sense that when you have a young person who wants to be a missionary for the church, and they don't, they're not here legally, they're still able to serve. The church accommodates them by sending them on a mission within the United States and keeping them out of trouble in that sense.
Mm-hmm. A very interesting observation, because we oftentimes associate Latino immigrants with Catholicism, which is the typical thing. There is a growing evangelical Protestant population within the Latino community, but when I was living down near Santa Ana, California, one of the interesting things I found was that a significant portion of the Latino immigrants, and this might be some of the illegal immigrants as well, happened to be Mormon. That was absolutely fascinating to find that out. In terms of immigration, there's this other realm of issues, too, that relates to the rest of the world, and that's foreign affairs. How do Mormons mesh up with other Americans when it comes to the view of interventionism, pro-Israel, anti-Israel? What do we have there?
Well, on both of those particular issues, support for Israel and support for preemptive military action, you find that Mormons are overwhelmingly in support. That is, they take the conservative position. And if you look at other data, so not just data we've collected, but that others have as well, you see that Mormons definitely view America as having a special, and frankly within the culture would be a God-given mission or mandate to be, you know, a light to the world, and therefore should not necessarily cooperate with other nations in international affairs if America feels that it should act on its own. That's very much a sense that permeates at least the American version of Mormonism. I'm not sure that would be necessarily what Mormons outside of the U.S. would hold to, but certainly within the U.S. that's what we see. So on that, on those questions, it's fair to describe Mormons as being pretty hawkish on foreign affairs.
Now, there's one issue that you didn't discuss in your book that puzzled me in terms of Mormons, and I watched the politics fairly carefully. I'm a political scientist and such. And the issue of school choice, which is typically one of smaller government, and this is one you would think Republicans, they jump on board on that, so you would think that Mormons would be all over this as well. So school choice, offering vouchers. But I think about 10 years ago, there was a referendum, a statewide referendum in Utah on school vouchers. And you know, when I was looking at the issue from the outside, I said, this is going to be a slam dunk for school vouchers. It turned out the exact opposite. In fact, I think the school vouchers went down 38% in favor, 62% for. What explains that?
This is Quinn. I was in the middle of that campaign, so I think it's probably easiest for me to address that one. Part of it is, you're right, you would expect on the surface, and I think it comes back to the larger issue that Mormons are conservative, but with a twist. There wasn't anything in particular from the church about vouchers. They stayed completely out of that one. But there is a sense, this sense of pragmatism. There is a respect for education that I think bleeds over into public education is works well in Utah. It's really quite underfunded, and that's a function of a high birth rate in part. But there's this pragmatic sense, and I think the opponents to the voucher initiative were able to exploit the fact that the people that put the initiative forward had kind of overshot their case. They had, and I don't remember the particulars now, but they were painted as taking the program way too far, that it had, that the provisions, they had added in some provisions that proved to be unpopular. So while people favored vouchers conceptually, this particular program took it a step or two far, and that's what was its undoing.
Tony, this is Dave again. Another important thing to note that, again, comes as a surprise to many many people who aren't familiar with Mormon culture is there aren't really Mormon private schools in the way that there's a Catholic school system and a Lutheran school system and, you know, even the Episcopalians and the Quakers and, you know, increasingly evangelical Protestants all have a network of schools. That's never really happened in Mormonism. You might say that, well, Mormons sort of had the public schools in Utah, and so there really wasn't the need for a private option. Today there are some schools in the Utah area, some that are charter schools that have sort of a vague LDS theme, and then there are a few private schools that you could say are kind of sort of LDS, but certainly nothing like what you would see in the Catholic sector or among evangelical Protestants. And that undoubtedly fed into the voucher debate as well. There just wasn't a lot at stake for most Mormons who were not going to be sending their kids or who weren't already sending their kids to a private school and therefore paying the tuition at that school.
Ironically, in Utah, the vast majority of the private schools are full of non-Mormons who are sort of seeking a refuge from the dominant Mormon culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. Quinn, since you just mentioned something a few moments ago about authority and leadership, and this is also something that you measured in one of your scales of Mormonness as well, there's a question out there in political science, and specifically in those folks who study religion and politics, is to what extent do religious individuals pick up cues from their leadership? And Mormon leadership is actually very interesting. It tends to be very hierarchical at the top of the pyramid, if you could think of it that way. But at the bottom, one of the things that fascinates me about the organization is that it's very voluntaristic. It rotates amongst individuals. Leaders of the wards are always changing every other year or so like that. To what extent have you found leadership in the Mormon Church sending political cues, and how do your regular lay Mormons pick up those cues, if at all?
Well, we attempted to measure the extent to which politics was talked about over the pulpit. And when we ask those kinds of questions, we find virtually never happens in terms of over the pulpit. So when you compare Mormon congregations to other national data that measures the same thing elsewhere, it's almost non-existent. But again, that's over the pulpit. What does happen is a host of conversations between Mormons, maybe in the hallways at church or in other meetings, and because their social networks are strong with each other, they inevitably talk about politics with each other, but outside of that structured church context most of the time.
Is there really a need to do it over the pulpit? Because again, you know, as we said, it's pretty cohesively Republican, so there's really no need to sway the population one way or the other. Is that part of the effect?
Well, and the church has a pretty strict political neutrality policy in terms of partisan politics. And again, you're right. It wouldn't be needed anyway. It's so strongly Republican that it's not like you need to persuade Mormons to be more Republican. But it does happen over the pulpit occasionally, right? And part of the point that we make in one of our chapters is that the rarity of that makes it quite noticeable among Mormons. So when a statement is read in California congregations in 2008. Encouraging church members to do everything they can to support Proposition 8 with their time and money. The response is quite overwhelming. Thousands of church members volunteer on the campaign, going door to door, doing telephone calls. About half of the $40 million raised by that campaign came from Mormons, by all accounts. And it was, you know, the Mormon participation on that campaign was, I think, the heart of it.
Remind our listeners what Proposition 8 was again.
Proposition 8 was an attempt to, a successful attempt at the time, to get California to ban gay marriage, so to overturn a court decision that had reversed a statutorial change. So they changed the law, the courts overturned it, they changed the Constitution, and then the courts overturned it.
And I remember watching this as well. It's not that long ago. The Mormon Church caught a lot of heat for that.
Yeah, that's right. And I think fairly or unfairly, they were at the church, and the church members were at the center of the campaign. And I think that's right. There were protests outside of Mormon churches and temples in California. I think there were some individual Mormons that were targeted that had donated money, that were singled out. I think, people lost their jobs. I think it was a difficult time for Mormons on both sides of the issue, frankly. It was hard to be, and this is a kind of, it was hard to be a Mormon in California, in the sense that you were at odds with the larger culture. It was a divisive issue statewide. It was especially difficult, I think, if you had a view within the church that favored gay marriage or was sympathetic to it, because there was so much emphasis within your congregation on getting involved that you would have felt a tremendous amount of pressure.
What is somewhat paradoxical, you just mentioned that there is not a lot of order taking, or I should say order giving, from the pulpit within the Mormons, but that one case seemed to gel everybody's image of the Latter-day Saints as taking images from on high, from Salt Lake City. And it really did create a difficult tension, or a difficult balancing act at a very critical time in politics for Mormonism. And that's going to lead me to the last section I want to talk about here. And that's what you call in your book the LDS or Mormon glass ceiling. And with the most recent presidential campaign, we had a Mormon candidate, wasn't the first one in presidential politics, because there were two others, I believe, in the past, but this was Mitt Romney being the person who was most likely to become the first Mormon president. And that really starts to change the game. There's a lot of discussion going on in the popular culture about Mormonism. The Latter-day Saints hierarchy actually engaged in We Are Mormon campaign. I remember the billboards all around Seattle here, and just trying to explain to people, okay, we got this Mitt Romney guy here. Here's what a Mormon is. Using the time in or that moment as a way of kind of leveraging the ability to explain what is going on. Dave, how has the Mitt Romney campaign affected Mormons in politics, if at all?
Well, it's an interesting question, Tony, because what we find, firstly, is that while Romney's Mormonism mattered a lot to him in 2008, that it was definitely a negative for him, by the time we get to 2012, where he'd already been introduced to the public, and of course in the general election when he's running as the Republican nominee against Barack Obama, the president that, of course, many Republicans have very strong opinions about, his Mormonism kind of faded away as an issue. But we do find that Mitt does seem to have affected at least perceptions of Mormonism. So while overall people's attitude toward Mormons has stayed pretty well the same from about 2006 to the present, that flat line disguises a very interesting change whereby today Republicans are much more favorable toward Mormons than are Democrats, with independents right in the middle. And it used to be that basically everyone disliked Mormons equally. Now Republicans like them more, Democrats like them less. Again, independents in the middle. And that appears to be a Romney effect. When we look at the data, it didn't happen after the Proposition 8 campaign in 2008, in spite of all the attention that that generated. It doesn't really appear until 2012, and it has persisted beyond the presidential election, because we initially thought, well, maybe this is just a fleeting Romney effect, but it seems to have been now baked into people's perceptions of Mormons. And we see that even when we run experiments where we give people a description of a hypothetical candidate for various offices, and we describe the candidate and give some biographical information, and then we just slip in that he's Mormon. And when we do that, you see Republicans flocking to that candidate, and you see Democrats pulling away, which isn't necessarily prejudice or anything like that. It could just be a reasonable inference about this candidate's politics, because the public perception of Mormons is that they are largely Republican, and that turns out to be accurate.
Has it affected people's view of Mormonism, not just as a political socioeconomic effect or that, but just Mormonism as a religion in general?
Well, that's what we seem to be picking up in the data, because the perceptions that I'm describing that are polarized along partisan lines are not just on political questions, but on people's sort of overall assessment of Mormons as a people. And that does suggest, actually, that politics has begun to bleed into people's perception of this religious group, which, frankly, I don't think is very healthy. I don't think it's very healthy for the larger spiritual mission of the LDS Church. I don't think it's actually healthy for the political environment in the United States. I think it's better that religion and politics remain separate in this sense of how people perceive different religious groups. You know, we're so polarized along political lines for so many things. To add religion to that as well, I think, is just an explosive mix.
And you've done research on this as well, explaining the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, as being in part and parcel a reflection of religion somehow coming together with politics too closely.
That's right. So generally speaking, what we find is more and more Americans, and especially young Americans, what are often called the millennials, that is people under 30, are turning away from religion. They're telling pollsters they don't even have a religious affiliation as a negative reaction to what they see as this politically infused religion that we have in the United States. So to them, religion equals conservative politics. They don't share those politics, therefore they don't have religion. And to the extent that any group gets tied up with either the Republicans or maybe in some cases even the Democrats, I just don't think it's healthy for that religious group, which presumably has a larger religious or spiritual mission as compared to a partisan one.
Yep, it's effects that we see not only here in America, but around the world as well. And my research on Latin America has shown that with the Catholic Church as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have a colleague who studies Poland, and she says it's exactly the same thing there as well. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, that is a topic for another show. We are in the process of finishing up here, and one of the questions I always like to ask my guest is not only about their research, but how their research has affected them. And as you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, you and Quinn had met at BYU, were sitting around having some lunch and said, hey, we got to write a book together about Mormons in America. You've written that book. And some reflections. In the process of writing that book, have you changed your views on politics, religion and politics, your own perception of your own faith? What say you on that?
This is Quinn. I'll go first. I think for me, one thing that I've reflected on quite a bit is this idea of partisanship that we've talked so much about. And the idea that for the time being, at least, Mormons are so Republican, but you can imagine a situation in which that could change over the long term. And I think it has to do again with the mix of what's happening in the larger society and what the parties are doing and what the church is talking about. And one of the things that the church repeatedly says, almost every election in recent memory, is something along the lines of principles compatible with the gospel, with the church, can be found in various political parties. parties, not, you know, so they're trying to point people away from this monolithic republicanism. I think it makes some of the church leaders uncomfortable even. And so I've tried to imagine, you know, what are the circumstances where that could change? And I don't see anything on the short-term horizon changing that. But, you know, it certainly could happen in the long term in terms of a de-emphasis on social issues, both in the church and in the larger culture, and maybe in the church as a response to the larger culture. So as gay marriage becomes more and more common and more accepted in public opinion, there's maybe a sense that that battle is kind of over, and not that that Mormons would change their views about it, but they'd maybe just stop fighting about it so much and talking about it so much and talk about something else. And if that, for example, turned to poverty and income inequality and helping the poor and so on, and you saw a lot of Mormon leaders talking about that, you might see a shift over toward the Democratic Party or away from the Republican Party if the parties maintain their differences on those kinds of issues as well. So there's, you know, there's lots of ifs in those statements, but that'll be fascinating to watch. You would never have assumed the rapid shift away from the Democratic Party toward the Republican Party by white Southern evangelicals, and yet it happened very, very quickly as a result of changes in the larger culture over the period of a decade. It was astounding. And so, you know, I like to sit back and think about those possibilities once in a while.
Dave.
You know, Tony, I think in my case, working on this book has really brought home to me how difficult it is for those Mormons who do not necessarily fit into the normal mold. You know, we've talked about the cohesiveness among Mormons and the political uniformity, and as we've noted, it's not complete uniformity. So maybe it's 70 or 75% Republican, but that still leaves a quarter who are Democrats. And on any one of these issues that we're talking about, it's not 100% of Mormons who necessarily endorse what we might think of as the quote-unquote Mormon view. That's true when it comes to gay marriage. You know, I was in California while we were working on this book, and I gave a talk there. And just to hear members of the LDS Church there who are on both sides of the gay marriage issue go through that experience and how painful it was and how it's still stings, again, on both sides, is really quite remarkable. And then in my own life, my wife is involved with an organization that is pushing for a greater voice for women in the LDS Church. And that's not a topic we really discuss much today, but it has been huge within LDS circles over the last year or so. And, you know, even though it's not by any means a majority of people in the church, there's a sizable number who really would like to see changes within the organization and are working very hard, exercising voice to try to make at least small, subtle changes to see women have a greater role. And at times that can be a very difficult and painful process. And it just reminds me of the dangers of making assumptions about members of a group, even if you are yourself a member of that group. Not everybody shares the same perspective and not everybody shares the same view. And in the case of Mormonism, it has shown itself to be remarkably adaptable over time. There have been big changes in Mormonism, and there's no reason to think that there won't be big changes coming. And I would hope that Mormons themselves remember that if they meet someone who might, within their own tribe, if you will, think a little differently or view things a little differently, that, well, maybe that different view will one day become the church's view, because, of course, that has been the history of the church.
Some very fascinating observations to leave off with, and I have to say that this interview with two people at the same time has worked out very well. I haven't had to ring the bell at all during the whole thing, so it's been a very enjoyable conversation. I would like to thank David Campbell and Quinn Monson for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. We've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Tony. Been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.